Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. 72 years old, a publication of political probity, cultural analysis, ideological introspection from a conservative perspective. Please join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and then ask you to pay $19.95 for a digital subscription and $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox, your actual physical mailbox, not your email box. Our current issue, the May issue, is now out with a remarkable lead article called Jewish Conservatism, a Manifesto, an amazing piece by art historian Michael J. Lewis about George W. Bush's book of paintings, wonderful pieces by Andrew Ferguson on the attack on Mike Pence and Matt Continetti on the attack on Nikki Haley. Please take a look. The issue is up at commentarymagazine.com for your perusal. With me, as always, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
So, North Korea, 105th birthday of the founder of North Korea, Kim Il-sung, this weekend. Big military parade, real fears that there was going to be a significant nuclear test that we in the United States might find ourselves retaliating against, either preemptively or after the fact. And the test, such as it was, fizzled on the launch pad and nothing happened. One hopes, one speculates, everyone speculates that the reason that many of these missile tests are failing is because we're gumming up the works in some covert fashion. Other people have pointed out that failure is a prerequisite to success in the creation of rockets. We, of course, had a series of horrible and disastrous and tragic rocket failures during the Gemini and Apollo missions before we sent our men up to the moon, where, you know, Apollo 8, which blew up on the launch pad and killed three astronauts and the like. So that these missiles seem to be failing does not mean that they will not succeed at some point in the distant or not too distant future, so that the North Korea issue remains open. Abe, your thoughts on what we must do toward North Korea?
Well, you know, we're going to everyone is very there's a heightened sort of panic now about what's going on for obvious reasons, but the truth is, unless we are content to ignore the problem forever, we're going to have to deal with some moment like this, some sort of question of, okay, what do we actually do to stop them? And it's going to look, these tests are not going to fail forever, whether they are whether the failures are a result of our gumming up the works or not, they're not going to fail forever. We're going to have to at least blow a missile out of the sky when it happens. If not something more extreme that I hesitate to even mention.
Right. I'm skeptical that we're going to have actually some sort of covert influence over the execution of a multi-stage missile launch. North Korea is a closed society. It's notoriously difficult to get assets into place in North Korea. So the notion
by assets, you mean covert agents who can physically, by hand, do something
correct
to interfere with this, except electronic.
Either American assets, Western assets, or defectors in place, because it's very easy to ferret those individuals out inside the Hermit Kingdom. So I'm not sure whether or not we actually have, I don't know, no, obviously, but whether we have assets on the ground there. But I'd be much more inclined to believe that this is simply something that happens very frequently because they have very rudimentary technology. They work it out. You know, we saw over just last year, I think, the process of developing a functional submarine-launched ballistic missile initially experienced quite a few failures, and then they did have a success, which is a very dangerous situation for us because it represents a second strike capability on the part of the North Koreans.
And also, they've successfully exploded. They've successfully achieved nuclear explosions.
Yeah,
which,
I mean,
which strikes me as harder.
Well, for a backward society, they're not so backward. That, right. That's what we learn, is that, you know, it's not like they, I mean, they can't feed their people, but that's a matter of choice, not a matter of, you know, a failure of will or a failure of science or technology. He wants to starve his people as a form of control, or the Kims, including the current scion, Kim Jong-un. So, I mean, the situation I think we're looking at is this question of, we spent 30 years basically buying, or 25 years basically buying the North Koreans off, and we are running out of the ability to do that. It was in 2003 that the Bush administration decided it could no longer maintain the fiction that North Korea was not a nuclear power, and basically said, we're not playing this game anymore. We know that you're nuclear, so we are not going to sort of pretend that we're buying you off to keep you away from splitting the atom.
Well, one of the weird things about this current crisis is it seems like a crisis by choice, by which I mean our choice. The notion that was peddled over the weekend is that we were going to either try to engage in intercept of a North Korean missile, or possibly engage in some sort of a targeted retaliation over the prospect of a sixth nuclear test. I have to believe that they know something that we do not, because I don't see the urgency in a sixth atomic test, unless we're talking about a thermonuclear test, some sort of a rudimentary hydrogen device, or the prospect of another multi-stage missile test, which ends up in the Sea of Japan. These are things that happen so frequently that it seems bizarre to escalate tensions to the point that we did. And to set the table of what that meant, an NBC News report, which has since been denied and denied and denied, but nevertheless contains, I think, a grain of truth over the prospect of our retaliation in the event of some sort of a new test by North Korea, set a lot of wheels in motion. It created a diplomatic crisis,
so
because
story,
North Korea...
The story said, we have to say what the story said, sure, which is that we were prepared to launch a military strike against North Korea after a test had taken place.
Now, that represents a crisis in itself, because now we've set the table. We say, North Korea, either you test and test, call our bluff, or your chickens. And that essentially would rob the regime of a lot of internal legitimacy, which is something the regime cannot afford. And so it was obviously going to move forward. In the event that they tested and we did not retaliate, we would lose face in the region. If we retaliated, that would spark some sort of a Chinese response. Either would have to abide by their obligations to Pyongyang, or they would have to back down and face similar problems in the region. So these sort of things you can't just say without meaning it and without having a contingency plan, because they set a whole bunch of wheels in motion.
We are told that the one thing that Obama told Trump during the transition, when they were having their serious transition conversations, president to president-elect, was North Korea is the number one problem facing the world, and you're going to have to do something about it. Now, that's a convenience for Obama, of course, because it means that he's implicitly saying you don't have to worry about Iran, for example. And Michael Oren, our old friend, commentary contributor, former Israeli ambassador to the United States, had a piece in the Wall Street Journal this weekend in which he said, don't be fooled. Iran is still the greatest threat to world peace, and not North Korea. And its program may have been slowed down a little bit, but it's still progressing. And the arms race in the Middle East that is already gaining force in the prospect of a nuclearized Iran 10 years from now is galloping forward. So we are in a position where Trump has been told by Obama, was told by Obama, that this is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. And I think it's very easy to look at what's happened in the last 3 or 4 weeks and say a lot of what's been done in and around Syria was in part to send a message to North Korea. Now, what the real question is, move forward 25 years to like 2041 or 2042, will there have been an engagement of some sort between the United States and North Korea? Or can this Cold War over North Korea's possession of nuclear weapons go on forever. I mean, there have been cases in which cold wars between the United States and much weaker and much smaller powers have gone on forever. We had the Cold War with Cuba, which went on forever until we basically unilaterally decided to end it. We don't really engage with countries that are not on our border that don't directly threaten us, you know, and North Korea is a very complicated case because we have 28,000 people under arms on the Korean Peninsula, and there are 17 million people living in and around Seoul, and North Korea could fire off not nuclear but totally conventional missiles at Seoul and kill hundreds of thousands of people. Now, the South Koreans can obliterate Pyongyang, for that matter. I mean, that's the part of all this where we say, well, we can't possibly engage North Korea because they'll attack South Korea. But, I mean, South Korea is not without its own ability to, you know, level North Korea also. So, you know, they're also in a Mexican standoff here.
I was playing with the theory, which should be a theory. I'm not sure if it is, but I'm going to coin it, which is rational dictator theory. So the prospect is you engage in a targeted, limited strike on, say, North Korea's capacity to make nuclear weapons and deliver nuclear weapons. Now, that's actually pretty darn impossible. We don't know where these things are. We don't know who their nuclear scientists are. They have mobile missiles that are moving around all the time. We really can't eliminate their capacity, but we can pinprick it. We can make it hurt. So North Korea now faces a choice. Do they respond, at which point we you talked about, which represents basically a strike on Seoul, using conventional materials? Now, their conventional weapons are just about as reliable as that missile that went off on the platform. It's artillery, for example, and grad rockets and that sort of thing. And some of them work, some of them don't. And every one of them you fire off no longer has a deterrent effect. So you can kill about a million people, maybe more, in Seoul. But every time you fire one of those things off, we target it, we eliminate it. So that's one of those things where you're like, you cannot keep that sort of a situation contained. If he responds, it ends up being a major regional war. China crosses the Yalu, we cross the DMZ, North Korea ceases to exist. But if he doesn't respond, he faces a crisis of confidence within his regime. So that's one of those things where it's like, what's the more rational response? I mean, from our perspective, the more rational response is to try to take the hit and to try to wait out the crisis and see how strong your position is in Pyongyang. And maybe it's not that strong. So maybe his rational response is to invoke, you know, a real major crisis on the Korean Peninsula, even if he doesn't survive it, because the alternative is to die at the hands of your own people.
But why would Kim die at the hands of his own people?
Because his regime would implode, or at least he would be removed from power. And if you're removed from power in North Korea, we don't really know what happens to you, but people in power tend to die really horrific deaths.
I will say that, you know, the savagery with which he is clearly willing to dispatch anybody, including exiles, in airports using major chemical weapons of mass destruction.
Dogs, anti-aircraft shells.
Right. Well, no, but I mean, the problem with all of these analyses and the anti-war analyses, let's say, I mean, not that anybody here for a war on the Korean Peninsula, but there was all this, it's really dangerous, the saber rattling. I've never been so scared. You know, what's going on? We're talking about this, doing something in Korea and all that is. This idea that the whole point is that this is a tin pot, miserable, horrendous regime dictatorship that is starving its own people and builds 105-story buildings that are uninhabitable because they are architecturally unsound. The one thing that has kept them from being swept away by the force of history has been this development of these nuclear weapons. So in theory, though, as Noah laid out, this is a scenario without much possibility of real-world success, as far as we know. If you could sweep away the nuclear weapons, the regime would collapse. I mean, there's no, you know, there'll be an internal coup, there'll be a series of civil whatever. I mean, it's just, there's no reason for it to exist.
Well, there's Well, the culture of fear around it. I mean, that's.
But I'm saying, when I say it has no reason to exist, I mean that it is the same country. They tell us that it's according to their own doctrine and logic. It's there's this country called Korea. It's divided into two as a result of a civil war, and it's one of those things where if you look at the pictures from the sky, you see, you know, in the south this totally vibrant first world economy, second to first world economy, and then this dark patch of black nothingness, right, which is North Korea. So South Korea is now 100 years more advanced than North Korea in every way, shape, or form, except that North Korea wisely and with a great understanding of the world's power politics decided to pursue and obtain nuclear weapons, which has made it unassailable.
Well, it had a nuclear program that was unsuccessful until, 2006? So it survived 15 years without...
No, it was 2003, and that Christopher Hill... It was 2003 when Christopher Hill acknowledged that South Korea had gone nuclear. And if you want to go back into the mist of memory, the Bush administration was criticized for having openly said that the North Korea went nuclear, because this was some violation of a gentleman's agreement in the world to pretend that it hadn't, as though that somehow were diplomatically wiser than acknowledging the existence of that the country had moved into a different kind of threat posture to the world. Now we stand here, we are in fully within not even Iraq terms. In terms of preemptive war, if they are developing, if they have nuclear material and they are developing an ICBM that can hit San Francisco, we are in any just war theory terms within our rights and moral reasons to level the regime to prevent it from being in a position to directly threaten millions of Americans with obliteration. That's the first time since the end of the Soviet Union that we are in that kind of position. And the Soviet Union, we in the Soviet Union, of course, had this kind of mutual assured destruction pact that was understood that we, you know, since we could each destroy the Earth, neither of us was going to do it. Well, North Korea can't destroy the Earth. It could just destroy, you know, far western part of the United States, and so we would be within our rights to take action.
And there's no reason to think that the logic of mutually assured destruction works on the Kim regime.
No, because they can't destroy us. They can't destroy us. They can destroy part of us, and we can literally turn the place into a crater.
Right. But what I mean
of
is,
of course, we don't turn. We are not going to turn it into a crater. But I mean, we can turn. They can't turn us into a crater. But we can turn the entire country into a crater.
What I mean is, but even there's no reason to assume that even that half of the logic of mutually assured destruction, their assured destruction,
right,
would necessarily works on the Kim regime.
Nor is this a proposition that we can engage North Korea from the air. We already have agreements with Japan that we are going to go into this country and rescue many of them, the hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians who are captive inside North Korea. And you have to use ground assets in order to ferret out this regime, which will likely be in survivable positions underground. So it's unlikely that even if you were to unleash the fires of nuclear hellstorm across North Korea and kill hundreds of thousands of civilians,
and by the way,
this
and
regime
that would also
fall.
and then of course the radiation, you don't know where the radiation cloud spreads.
Furthermore,
the radiation cloud could also go and then kill hundreds of thousands of South Koreans.
Furthermore,
which is not our
the
goal.
Just war theory doesn't suggest that you'll be able to quell opposition to such an operation inside the United States. Just look at how unreliable their tests are, and you can see how the opposition around such a strike would materialize. Ah, this isn't
right.
A real threat. They're not going to be able to have a deliverable weapon. Yeah,
right.
Maybe they can reach Japan, but they'll never reach the United States. Why do we care?
Right.
And also,
right,
the real threat that the left just absolutely poo-poos and believes is not a real threat. There's many real threats, but one real threat that the left doesn't seem to see as a real possible threat is the possibility of a thermonuclear detonation in the Earth's atmosphere, which would really create havoc in the form of a EMP. And people on the left think that's just nonsense. It's BS. It doesn't really exist. If it does exist, it's impossible for it to actually
happen.
The
EMP is called the electromagnetic pulse, and it is a theoretical result of what
happens. It's not theoretical.
No, it's not theoretical. So after a nuclear after a major nuclear strike, if the strike is in the atmosphere, it would basically take out the electrical
fries with a computer chip.
Right. So
that's not hard.
And not just the computer chip. I mean, also any conventional circuitry, right. Anything electrical is hit with a pulse that takes it out.
Forever. You can't repair it.
Yeah. So, you know, this is a scenario. I published an article about the threat of the EMP in the third or fourth issue of the Weekly Standard in 1995.
It's completely bizarre.
Which is
that
called
this
How We,
partisan.
A piece, a sort of scenario thing called How We Lost the High Tech War of 2016, if I remember correctly, or 2015. And it basically, this is something that the military has been panicked over since they discovered its existence, you know, for 30 or 40 years. And so far, there is, you know, this is, again, this is if North Korea is the 800-pound gorilla in the room, the EMP is the...
It's not military infrastructure that would be the threat there. It's civilian
infrastructure. No, civilian. It's all... we wouldn't have phone line. We couldn't talk to each other
on
the phone.
Trains wouldn't run. Refrigerators would stop working. Cars
everything,
would run dead in
everything.
The street.
Everything.
Planes would fall out of the sky.
Yeah, I mean, wherever you were...
And
I mean,
nothing turns back on again.
It's not forever. It's not everywhere unless there's a, you know, unless there are 25... nuclear strikes that hit everywhere in the United States. It's where the blast zone is, and you know, and above the blast zone, there is no defense for it. It's one of the reasons, by the way, one of the sotto voce reasons that we developed Star Wars, or this notion of taking out intercontinental ballistic missiles in the atmosphere. It wasn't just so that they wouldn't land and hit the Earth. The idea was if you hit them in the right place at the right time with the original idea being this notion of these mini missiles called Brilliant Pebbles, that you could disable the missile before it exploded in the atmosphere and caused the electromagnetic pulse.
Because the first wave of a massive retaliatory response to a nuclear attack is an EMP attack.
Right. So all we're saying here is it's a fiendishly difficult problem. And then this goes back to the question of whether the Trump administration and the Trump White, though we have... you know, a remarkable Secretary of Defense and Secretary of Defense Mattis, and a remarkable military strategist and National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster. We have a novice at State, you know, someone who has never been a diplomat before. We have no staff at State. There's no staff at Defense. There's a very strange staff seeming to be working at the National Security Council, and this is like no time for us to get involved in a major war in the Korean Peninsula when there's no civilian command and control of anything, as far as one can tell. I mean, if you want to wise up and say something serious and significant is going on in the United States that requires our, you know, or in the world, this is where, you know, Trump could call in Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi doesn't really play a role here, but Chuck Schumer and Dick Durbin and the Democratic leaders of the Senate, and say, look, we have to get staffed up. Things are getting crazy out there. We need to have a fully functioning Pentagon and State Department and Department of Homeland Security and CIA and NSA and intelligence community, because, you know, this is no joke. But of course,
I think the problem
he's standing giving speeches next to a giant Easter bunny with glasses on today.
Correct.
So.
You know, but you know, regarding Trump, I mean, I think this also goes to Noah's point that they know things that we don't know, because he is not someone who seemed terribly interested in starting American wars, despite what his enemies had said of him during the campaign. He was warmongering was not at all his thing.
Except he said he wanted to bomb ISIS.
Sure,
that
right,
was it.
Right,
basically,
right.
He just wanted to bomb the S out of ISIS.
Right, right. But there was never the prospect of a confrontation with North Korea. He didn't. That's not something that he talked up. You know.
And yet here we are.
Right, right.
So it's serious.
Right. But you know, and the thing is that for the left and for even certain parts of the right, there's never a good time to deal with these things. There's certainly not a good time to deal with it before we reach the brink of a real crisis, because then. What are we doing? Preemption is cruel and crazy, unnecessary. It can all be handled, And now, on the other end of the equation, it's not the right time because now it's actually dangerous.
Well, look, the problem with North Korean policy and the problem with the policy toward Iraq before the first Gulf War and the policy in these cases where what you say is you see this kind of irredentist threat, Iran too, you see this irredentist threat. And so you humor yourself if you are a foreign policy major domo. You humor yourself with the idea that because the threat doesn't ripen under your watch, that you have done something successful. So that in the case of North Korea, we bought them food aid, we did this, we gave them support. We did things that actually made sure that the regime did not collapse in order to buy them off from developing a nuclear capability. And it worked to delay them for 10 years, but then they developed a nuclear capability. So here we are now. So when people like us say we need to invest in democracy promotion, one of the things we talk about when we talk about this is the notion that you want to support forces all over the world that are attempting to make changes within society so that those societies change within themselves so that we are not put in this Hobson's choice position of having to intervene 25 years later when the threat that they pose is actually so large that action itself is a danger. Democracy promotion isn't just, you know, la-di-da, you know, kumbaya of the right. It's an idea about how to help countries transition away from the dangers that they pose into something else. So without that, all you have is, well, you can't do anything. You can't strike them militarily, that's too dangerous. You can't negotiate with them because that's too weak. You can't. So basically you're just in a state of complete paralysis.
Or you're reliant on bad actors, frankly,
like
Beijing, which has zero interest in the collapse of this regime, actually has a very large stake in maintaining it so that it does things like withhold coal exports to Pyongyang as that's a measure of its new commitment to the hemming in of this regime, as though that's going to result in some sort of a real change in behavior. Not only will it not, I believe, result in a real change in behavior, but it'll result in a regime that is far more paranoid, much more likely to act in aggressive ways internally and unpredictable ways externally. And it again, as John said, will result in only our paralysis because China's doing something now. So now we've outsourced the mission to China and we can't interrupt that.
Yeah, we have to let it play out. Strategic patience. We have to see what the Chinese are going to do. Well, the Chinese, like the North Koreans, as a counterweight to South Korea, Taiwan, and Japan, which are, of course, allies of the West, and China is many things, but it is not exactly an ally of the West. It views itself in a centuries-long, you know, contest for economic and
global
political
primacy.
Primacy and in which, you know, if you really want to be the prime actor, then you have to be in some condition of tension with the other prime actor. We don't feel that that is necessary, but they have a different view. And
a unified Korean Peninsula with a hostile government, which is a pro-Western government, is something that Beijing will not accept.
Right. Now, we saw something very tragic over this weekend. It's very easy to kind of to gloss over with another part of the world, in Turkey, where a century-long experiment in governance of an Islamic country that isn't Islamist or isn't is not conducted, to further the power and ambition of the Islamic Ummah, but rather to further the national goal of the Turkish people, has basically come to an end. So Turkey voted this weekend in a referendum essentially to grant President Erdogan lifetime powers, or in which he will not face any kind of public judgment until the year 2029, I believe. Fundamentally, it's a it's the end of a democracy, and interestingly enough, the end of a democracy through a simple referendum, thus once again providing when people, you want to attack the Electoral College, go ahead and attack the Electoral College. The existence of phenomena like the Electoral College and the two-thirds vote to pass treaties and pass constitutional amendments and do impeachments and all of that, all of these supermajority requirements in our Constitution have just been retroactively justified by the fact that Turkey has voted itself out of democratic existence with a 51% vote.
Yeah, I think there's a real lesson here, and it's that this should really shame a lot of people who have been screaming about the death of American democracy and you know, how the certain doom of our freedom. This is what that actually looks like when you extinguish balances of power and weaken independent judiciaries and things like that. None of that is actually happening here. You have a sort of loudmouth candidate you don't like, a loudmouth president you don't like, the policies you don't agree with. Not at all the same thing, and the difference should be glaring.
No, we see two examples of it, right? We see the example in Turkey, which has been in the process, in the works now for 10 years. This Erdogan has been playing a very long game with Turkey's relation to the West, its relation to democracy, its relation to NATO, its relation to the United States, that has now reached its fulfillment.
And secularism.
Well, that, more important, that's more internal, right? That's this thing where basically he came to power as the first Islamist premier, president of the country, where the secularist nature of the democracy had been protected. The secularist nature of the country had been protected by the military, which was the most liberal, which was actually a liberalizing force in the country. So we have there, and then of course we have Venezuela, which is a particular interest of Noah's, where since the election of Hugo Chavez in the year 2000, the right now, his successor, Maduro, is seeking to do exactly the same thing, which is destroy any independent power structure to him.
Yeah, I mean, he faced a fair bit of opposition from people in the streets. I mean, the backstory here is the most recent outbreak of violence in Venezuela, which we're in the middle of, the biggest outbreak of violence since 2014, where we had some really serious anti-government protests met with a forceful response by the Venezuelan authorities. On March 29, the Supreme Court, protesting the seating of some delegates to the National Assembly that they didn't like, that they thought were inappropriate or elected illegitimately, just voided the authority of the National Assembly, vested in itself legislative powers. And because this is essentially Maduro's regime and those are Maduro loyalists, this is Maduro's socialist dictatorship. People took to the streets. They didn't like it. Lots of protests. The Supreme Court reversed itself 3 days later. 2 weeks after that, we are still seeing violence on the streets. At least 5 people died as of last Friday, including a 13-year-old girl. And the Trump administration has been quicker to respond than the Obama administration to the Venezuelan situation. Right when they got into office, they sanctioned the new vice president, who just happened to be a drug lord, who is implicated in exporting drugs to Mexico and the United States. They moved real fast, much faster than the Obama administration, which didn't do anything in 2014, waited for Congress to designate the Venezuelan regime a threat to the United States, and then Obama administration moved and said this is a national security issue and thus allowed them to sanction some individuals. But that was well after the violence had been quelled violently. Violence quelled violently. It was kind of redundant. So we're in the middle of something that's a situation that's clearly a crisis for the regime. They're vulnerable. We don't have a ton of national interests there, but the Obama administration had a political objective of nurturing, you know, a rapprochement with Latin American Marxists. The Trump administration doesn't have any of that sort of baggage, so they could give this thing a push. And I think they should, and I kind of don't know why we're not seeing very much action on the part of this White House, with the exception of the fact that they're really busy.
Nobody working in the State Department, Noah. We don't have anybody working in the State Department. That's why there's no policy on secondary issues like Venezuela, because we don't have an assistant secretary, deputy secretary of state, or an assistant secretary of state for inter-American affairs whose job it is to spend 24 hours a day on an issue like this. But the larger point here is that we are seeing after the rush of enthusiasm for democracy and democratic government that began really in the 1980s and flourished through around sort of 2010, let's say, we're seeing this terrible retrenchment, and we have it on the left in the Maduro case, we have it on the right, let's say. You could sort of say that about Erdogan.
You could sort of say that about the populist movements in Europe.
Right, no, but I mean, they haven't taken over yet, but I mean, I guess Erdogan really sort of counts as a rightist. The difference in the case of Venezuela, of course, is that the country is in a situation in which basically there's no food and they're rationing elementary items of food, whereas Erdogan's success in Turkey is entirely due to the economic prosperity that the country, that he helped the country achieve through whatever modality, I'm not entirely sure, but the country has been in good health economically since he took power, and that's his ballast. His ballast is that he can say that he brought prosperity to the country, but all over the place. I mean, obviously, Central Europe, the Russian near abroad, Putin himself.
You know, but this goes to show, I mean, it really explodes one of the lazy, arrogant myths of the Obama years, and it's a big myth on the left generally, and it's one that Obama promoted. Noah, as you mentioned in a post you wrote about Venezuela last week. What did Obama say that time? I forget where he was speaking, and he said, you know, something to the effect of, look, your generation, he was speaking to younger people, your generation doesn't need to worry about all the ideological wars anymore, the ideological fights of the Cold War between, you know, freedom, between communism and capitalism, between, you know, you're either a Yankee dog or a whatever he said, you know, that doesn't matter anymore. Today you just have to worry about what works. It's all just about what works. This comes back to the pragmatic issue, you know. And in fact, that's not at all the case. There are many people willing to say, no. A lack of freedom can work.
Right.
They're wrong, but they it's not self-evident to them.
What do you mean works?
Right.
The great novelistic, dystopic, satirical portrait of this comes in a novel by Vasily Aksionov, the Russian emigre writer, called The Island of Crimea. Which got some attention about 3 years ago when Crimea was suddenly in the news because the Soviet Union decided to... Russia decided to...
It's an easy mistake to make.
Yes, decided to assert its sovereignty over... violent sovereignty over Crimea. But he posits in the book that Crimea is an island, not a connected piece of land. It's an island, and that it was not taken over by the Soviet Union after the Russian Revolution, and that it developed as an independent Western democracy, and that in the 1980s, as a movement began rising up in Crimea, sponsored in part by ethnic Russians in Crimea, the novel posits, to rejoin the motherland, as they put it, and that this democracy, this 60-year-old democracy in his vision, could not withstand the emotional pressure of this notion that they should somehow get themselves back into, they were a small, nothing nation, and they could be part of this great international project for freedom and, you know, and equality across the world. And the book ends with the Russian tanks rolling through the streets of the towns and the end of this project. And part of it is this very sour portrait by a great Russian Soviet satirical writer of the never dying hunger in the Russian soul for authoritarian dictators and totalitarianism. But in a larger sense, what we are seeing with this retrenchment of democracy is that there are forces greater than your freedom, your personal prosperity, all of that, that there are much larger forces
and that
are much more emotionally potent forces that can be brought to bear.
And that still have to be fought. You know, it all still has to be fought out. As much you think that the evidence of history is in and now we know what's nice and what works, it's not true at all.
I think it was Sohrab's piece, and I guess it was
Sohrab Amari.
Sohrab Amari, and I'm not sure when that was. I think it was almost a year ago.
It was June, yeah, June 2016 on illiberalism, the rise of illiberalism.
The rise of illiberalism, as this commentary. Democratic wave retreated in Commentary magazine, which you can Google. But yeah, it was on specifically this rise of a populist right is challenging this this democratic wave that sort of crested, I guess, in 1980, and now we're watching it retreat.
And of course, in France, just to end on an even happier note, in France, what we are seeing in as this election gets close to its point is that the vaunted coming to their senses and finding appropriate middle seems not to be happening, that we have essentially an extreme, a right-wing extremist in Marine Le Pen and a left-wing extremist in Mr. Mélenchon, and then sort of two ineffectual moderates in the middle, and there is going to be like a four-way tie, which means that it's almost certain that it's likely that one of the extremists will end up prevailing, and France's connection to who knows where that goes from there. I mean, we have literally kind of a lineup of forces. It's as though, you know, Noam Chomsky was the one candidate and Mike Cernovich was the other candidate, and that's where we are. We're going to talk about some other stuff, but we're running out of time. We're going to talk about the riots in Berkeley. Maybe we'll talk about them later in the week. Let's try to keep a tickler on that so that we can enlighten you on the some of the collapse in civil society in the United States that you may not be hearing about. But we're done. So for Noah Rothman and Abe Greenwald, I'm John Podhoretz of Commentary Magazine. Keep the candle burning.